Chapter 13. While judges usually didn't prepare search warrants, the Honorable Nathan R. Prelate was the exception. After serving 4 terms as Hickman County District Attorney and having served for 10 years on the bench, he knew the recitations of the common residential search warrant front to back. When Charlie Altman called him early Christmas morning, he promised Charlie that he would have the warrant ready and signed, waiting for him by the time Charlie arrived at Nathan's house. Judge Prelate lived in a white salt box with a sea-blue roof right on Washington Street, 4 blocks west of the square. He was the father of 2 college-age girls who threw outrageous parties and caroused with young men and women, no end, all to the judge's ongoing embarrassment and mortification time after time. While Judge Prelate himself was no goody-good, he did like a beer or two every now and then, his daughters were beyond the pale. When he got up out of bed that morning to go downstairs to his office and print out a search warrant, he peeked inside the girls' rooms as he went by. One girl was asleep with the bare arm of some unidentified individual, man or woman, across the daughter's T-shirted chest. The other daughter was missing from her room, evidently deciding to spend Christmas Eve away. She was MIA, Judge Prelate thought to himself. All in all, he had given up trying to control them while they were yet in high school. Now he only hoped and prayed that they didn't commit some horrendous crime or kill someone while they were driving under the influence. So far, he crossed his fingers for the umpteenth time, the girls avoided those plagues and poxes. In pajamas and bathrobe, he stole into his office and turned on the computer. He hit the printer switch. Both machines kicked into their startup routines, and Judge Prelate went to fix 2 Keurig coffees while he waited for Charlie to show. They had done this often enough that he knew Charlie liked his coffee black, 2 sweetened lows and a to-go cup. He was always in a hurry at these moments, and this morning would be no different. Just before dawn, Charlie swung into the judge's driveway and pulled even with the back door. He leapt up the concrete steps and knocked on the porch. A white plume of air escaped his mouth as he waited, shifting anxiously from foot to foot. This wasn't going to be fun. They all liked Ermeline. They all felt sorry for what had happened to her at Victor's bus.
"This is going to be a sad Christmas morning,"
Judge Prelate said as soon as he opened the door for Charlie. It was almost as if he had been reading Charlie's mind.
"Not for a second do I think she was involved, Nathan," Charlie replied. "Got the coffee ready?"
"Come on in the office. We're all set."
In the office, a small mahogany-paneled room with a trestled table desk and a computer desk, they took a seat on either side of the table. Judge Prelate raised his right hand and Charlie copied him.
"Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?"
"I do so swear,"
Charlie replied, and reached for his steaming styrofoam coffee.
"Please proceed. There will be no record."
"My name is Charles M. Altman, and I am the duly elected sheriff of Hickman County," Charlie began.
He then went into a long recitation of what he had heard that morning and what he had seen. He believed there was probable cause to believe a crime had been committed, a murder, and he believed there was a reasonable suspicion to search the premises inhabited and controlled by one Ermeline Ransom in an attempt to locate evidence of said crime. He described the single gunshot wound between Victor Harrow's eyes and the strange carving embedded in his forehead, ERM. He described how Ermeline had been earlier attacked by Victor Harrow, who had made a similar carving, it was alleged, in her breasts, when he carved his name in her breasts one night while she was drugged inside the same bus where Victor Harrow's body was found just this morning. Based on all the foregoing, he believed there was reasonable suspicion to search her home located at 323 Sycamore Drive, Orbit, Illinois. Judge Prelate listened attentively. When Charlie finished, he nodded and removed the cap from one of his many Mont Blanc pens. With a great flourish, he signed his name boldly at the bottom of the search warrant, stamped it with the clerk of the court seal he kept one at home just for such occasions, and signed and stamped a second copy, which he handed to the sheriff, along with the pink return. The return was the sheet on which Sheriff Altman would enumerate the items seized, if any, from Ermeline's residence. The sheet would then be returned to the clerk of the court for filing, which would close the loop on the search warrant process.
"If you see Leona," Judge Prelate said, "lying dead along the road somewhere, please tell her her dad's looking for her."
Charlie winced. He was glad he had no daughters. Back inside the squad, Charlie radioed dispatch and asked for 2 city cops and 2 deputies to meet him at 323 Sycamore Drive, 6 a.m. Dispatch acknowledged, and Charlie sat in Judge Prelate's driveway, sipping his coffee and killing 10 minutes while the troops assembled for the search. At 6 a.m., they converged on Ermeline Ransom's home, and Charlie Altman rapped his gloved hand sharply against the front door.
"Ermeline!" he called out. "Sheriff Altman, we need to talk to you."
At 9 o'clock, Thaddeus arrived at the Hickman County Jail. It was the earliest he could get in to see Ermeline, who had been instructed not to say one word to the police. This was hours earlier. Charlie Altman had honored that, went beyond honoring that, in fact, making sure that none of the peace officers spoke with her, in order to keep her from saying anything she might later regret. Upon his arrival at the sheriff's office, he was immediately ushered into Sheriff Altman's office, where he found Charlie waiting to meet with him, a very grim look on his face. He scowled at Thaddeus, shook his hand, and said,
"Hell of a way to spend Christmas morning, Thad."
Thaddeus nodded.
"Poor girl. Please tell me what we know so far."
They had converged on Ermeline's house at 6 that morning. The warrant team consisted of Sheriff Altman, Deputy Michael Smith, and Patrolman Stafford and Arnott of the Orbit PD. They had met no resistance to entry. The door had been answered by Georgiana Armentrout, Jr., the mother of Ermeline Ransom. Evidently, she had been asleep on the Davenport. Mrs. Armentrout had asked them to wait while she summoned Ermeline. Ermeline was still getting into her bathrobe when she came into the living room. Ermeline's heart thumped in her chest when she saw them. This couldn't be good for police? In her house? At 6 a.m., Christmas morning, which was when Jamie left from bed to see what Santa had brought with his reindeer. The sheriff asked Mrs. Armentrout, Ermeline, and Jamie if they would please wait on the couch. He explained to Ermeline that he had a search warrant to search the premises. It had been signed by Judge Nathan R. Prelate just an hour before and was all legal and adequate. Ermeline took the search warrant and started reading. Her hands were shaking, and the paper rattled as she read. Tears came to her eyes.
"Fruits of the crime?"
she asked Sheriff Altman.
"You're looking for fruits of the crime? What crime is that?"
she wanted to know.
"Ermeline, this isn't easy to say. Victor Harrow was murdered last night. Shot to death."
"Oh, my stars,"
cried Mrs. Armentrout. She reached and took her daughter's hand.
But why me?"
Ermeline exclaimed, her voice anguished and frightened.
"Someone carved ERM in his forehead."
"Oh, no,"
she cried.
"Charlie, on my honor, I swear that wasn't me."
"Ermeline,"
Charlie said softly,
"let's have an agreement. Let's have you not say any more for right now. Is that okay?"
She sniffled and wiped her eyes with the back of her hand.
"Give Mommy a tissue,"
she told Jamie, who climbed off the couch.
"No, son," said Sheriff Altman. "You wait right there. Please don't anyone leave the couch until we're finished."
"Okay,"
the sheriff told his deputy and the two cops.
"Search the premises. Remember, we're looking for a gun, maybe a knife, which is doubtful."
The men spread through the small house and began opening drawers, looking behind pictures, kicking aside rugs, and moving furniture, books, potted plants, lamps, knickknacks, jamming their hands inside the pockets of clothing, turning boots and shoes upside down and feeling across the top shelves of closets, spreading linens and sweaters on the lower. For the next 30 minutes, Ermeline and her mother exchanged whispers and shed tears while the police went about their business. They made her open her closet safe. They counted the money inside and made notes. Then it was locked again. Then one of the cops called to Sheriff Altman.
"I think we've got something,"
he said, excitement creeping in his voice.
"But I'm afraid to move things around. Bring a stool."
Sheriff Altman picked up the kitchen stool and met the patrolman in Ermeline's bathroom.
"Top shelf,"
he directed.
"On top the towels there."
Sheriff Altman climbed to the second rung and peered inside. He recognized it immediately. A .38 caliber snub nose, affectionately known as a detective special. It was silver nickel plate, though most were gun metal in color.
"Somebody hand me an evidence bag,"
Sheriff Altman muttered with his head partly inside the bathroom wall closet. Someone else handed him latex gloves, which he snapped on. The evidence bag followed, which was nothing more than a plastic bag about the size of a woman's purse, and across the top seal there was a writable label. Sheriff Altman withdrew a ballpoint from his shirt and wrote on the label, "Bathroom closet, top shelf, Sheriff Altman." With his gloved hand, he then withdrew the pistol and carefully laid it inside the bag. He was careful only to touch it once, so that any fingerprints went undisturbed. Then he stuck his hand further inside the cubby and withdrew a 10-inch switchblade. There were streaks of blood along the bone handle.
"Give me another bag."
A second bag was handed up, and Charlie repeated the same process. Into the bag, write the location of recovery, sign name of officer. He stuck his head all the way inside then and shone his light around, going down shelf by shelf until he was once again standing on the bathroom floor. He switched off his flashlight.
"Not good, boys," he said to the deputy and patrolman who had made the find. "Not at all good."
He was speaking almost in a whisper, as if not to alarm the small family waiting in the living room. The search then continued inside the house. 30 minutes later, they were finished. The evidence bags were removed through the back door. Ermeline, son, and mother never saw them.
"No need to upset them any more than we already have," Sheriff Altman told his assistants. "Mike, you take the seized items back to Vicaro's bus. The ISP crime lab is there. Please turn it over to them and ask them for the usual workup."
"Will do,"
said Officer Smith, who took custody of the two bags with the greatest of care and tore off in his patrol unit, lights flashing, siren silent. It was just after 7 a.m., and the search was concluded. Sheriff Altman returned to the living room.
"Mrs. Armantrout," he said, "would you keep your eye on the little guy today, for a while at least?"
"Why?"
said Mrs. Armantrout, her hand at her throat protectively.
"What is Ermeline going to be doing?"
Sheriff Altman turned to Ermeline.
"I wonder if you would put on your clothes and ride uptown with me. I've got a few housekeeping chores I need to do with you."
"Am I under arrest?"
Ermeline managed to say. Her mouth was dry. She had had nothing to drink since coming awake, and her breathing had been frantic all the last hour. A cold bead of sweat had broken across her forehead, and her pupils were constricted with fear. Sheriff Altman said nothing at first. Then, slowly, he nodded.
"I'm afraid you are. I'm afraid I'm going to have to arrest you on suspicion of homicide."
"Dear me,"
said Mrs. Armantrout.
"Call Thaddeus,"
was all Ermeline had to say. Her mother nodded. She had heard and would do so.
"Let me get dressed."
Sheriff Altman sat down on the couch to wait for Ermeline. He was certain she had no access to a weapon of any kind in the bedroom where she was dressing. They had searched every inch of it that morning, not once, but twice. Ermeline reappeared, purse over her arm, and she told Sheriff Altman she was ready. She hugged Jamie, kept the tears from flowing, and told him she would be back before he knew it. The little boy cried. This wasn't how Christmas was supposed to go. He knew that for a fact. Sheriff Altman looked away. Thaddeus had been sitting in the sheriff's office while the account of the search and seizure was repeated by the sheriff himself. He was holding a Starbucks in one hand and writing furiously on a legal pad as the story was told. Finally, he looked up.
"That's it? Nothing else seized?"
Sheriff Altman shook his head.
"There was nothing else to seize."
"And the gun and knife? They're with the Illinois State Police Crime Lab as we speak?"
"They are. Officer Smith reported it on the radio. I'll file the return on the search warrant tomorrow when the clerk's office opens."
"Please, let me see her now."
"Dad, one more thing."
"Yes?"
"She rode up to the office with me. In the front seat, no cuffs. We fingerprinted her, took her picture, got her some coffee. She sat in my office while I filled out the arrest report. Then we put her in the women's cell. No one else with her in there. She asked to be let out once to use the restroom. Most important, we haven't tried to statementize her. Nobody's asked her a thing."
"I appreciate that, Charlie. I'll tell her what you've done. Thank you."
"You're welcome."
They led Thad to the cells along a narrow, dark hallway and opened a second door. Two cells were in a shorter hallway. It, too, was dark. Ermeline was in the cell on the right, half in and half out of a shaft of Christmas morning light pouring through the window. Her face was tear-stained, and she was clutching an empty styrofoam cup. The coffee was long gone. The cup shook in her hand. She gave out a small cry when the jailer opened the cell and Thaddeus entered. She leapt to her feet and threw both arms around his shoulders.
"What is going to happen to Jamie?"
was all she said. Then she was weeping uncontrollably. She soon stopped crying and sniffed hard, once, and half smiled.
"Help me."
"I'll make sure he's okay," Thaddeus responded. "If this goes on beyond today, we'll make sure your mom has temporary custody."
"Who gets to decide that?"
"Judge Prelate makes the final decision." Actually, he just rubber stamps whatever recommendation is made by Naomi Killen over at DCFS, Department of Children and Family.
I know who they are. They helped me out when Hector flew the coop and left me without a penny even for groceries. We ate that first week because of DCFS. I know June, too.
She's a good lady. She'll do the right thing for Jamie. Thaddeus took a seat on the bunk opposite Ermeline's bunk. They were actually concrete slabs embedded in the concrete walls on which lay mattress pads, the kind that unroll, probably 2 inches thick. A folded army blanket covered the foot of each bed. On the far wall was a stainless steel toilet, no lid, with several sheets of toilet paper loose on the floor. He opened his iPad, fired up his litigation software, and started in. First off, do you know why you're here?
They think I had something to do with Vic's death.
Did you?
Did I kill Vic? Absolutely not. I swear it, Dad. On my mother's name.
I'm sure, but I have to ask anyway. He made a note on the iPad, then lifted his eyes. Do you know anything about it at all? Anyone tell you anything? Any rumors at the dome?
Nothing. I just heard of it this morning.
Have you seen or heard anything unusual in the last day or two?
Only Hector.
Tell me about that.
Hector came in the Silver Dome last night. He came over to my place after work. He was gone when I woke up this morning.
You're not getting back with him, are you?
Damn no. He wanted to be there for Christmas. He paid me over $6,000 in past support.
Where's the money?
In my purse, I guess. I didn't look. They took my purse.
She indicated the front of the jail. Where would Hector have gotten $6,000 to pay you?
Working, I guess.
And you let him come over to your house? Did he sleep with you?
He slept in my bed, on top the covers while I was under. He never touched me the entire time. He didn't see me naked, nothing.
What happened once you were in bed?
I went straight to sleep. I had just pulled a 10-hour shift and was dead.
What did he do, if you know?
Went to sleep too, I guess. Like I say, he was gone by the time Charlie Altman came.
Do you know where he went?
Unknown.
Do you have a number for him? Cell phone?
No. He was just going to be there a couple of hours this morning, then leave. We didn't trade numbers or anything.
What did you find out about him? Anything?
He told me he was living in the Gulf of Mexico somewhere, working for some company, something about cleaning up oil spills.
Thaddeus typed BP in the margin of his notes, followed by get BP records on Hector. Let me change this subject just a little. Did you see Victor Harrow last night?
He hasn't been back to the dome since I got cut up. No, he wasn't there last night either.
You didn't go out to his bus or even to his house for that matter?
No and no. Like I said, I went straight home after work.
What time did you get off? She thought a minute.
Off at midnight. Left about 12:10 after the tills were counted. Everything balanced, so we left right away.
We?
Me, Bronco, and Bruce. But Bruce was in the package store mostly. It was just me and Bronco.
When did you first see Hector?
He came in the dome, about 9 or 10.
Did he talk to anyone?
I didn't see him talking to anyone.
Did anyone else know he was there?
Well, Bronco told me he was there. He had seen him. No, that's not quite right. Bronco told me someone was there who I might know. That was it.
Where was he when you first saw him last night?
At the end of the bar, closest end of the front door, drinking a tap bud.
Was he talking to anyone?
Not that I saw.
Thaddeus raised a hand. Let's get some coffee. He called to the jailer, a frail-looking older gentleman wearing khaki jeans, boots, and a brown deputy shirt without any of the insignia, chevrons, badges, or other emblems that police wear.
So you're the stripped-down model? Thaddeus said to the man as he unlocked the cell.
Do you think we could get a couple of coffees in here?
What do you think this is, the Ritz?
The old gentleman said with a laugh.
I guess so. How do you take him?
Thaddeus and Ermeline gave their orders, and the man shuffled off.
Nice thing about being in jail in a small town. Room service, Thaddeus said jokingly, but Ermeline's eyes filled with tears and she sobbed again. It was all too much, and the reality hit her again.
But you get to leave,
she cried.
How long do they plan on keeping me today? What about Jamie and his Christmas? Am I going to miss that?
Thaddeus reached across and gave her shoulder a squeeze.
Listen, Ermeline, there's something else. The police found a gun and a knife in your house. What?
She said incredulously. Her fists pounded the thin mattress.
Hector left those. He planted them. I don't have a gun.
That's what I think, too. That's why I'm asking you all these questions about Hector. We need to prove he was inside your house.
My mom was asleep when we got there. I doubt if she ever saw him.
I doubt that, too. But I think I see what's going on.
Which is?
Thaddeus and Ermeline stopped talking when the jailer returned with two steaming styrofoam cups.
Charlie says with his compliments, he said.
Please tell Charlie we said thank you, and thanks to you, too.
Just whistle when you're ready to leave.
Ermeline gave a harsh laugh.
Does that include me, too?
The old man stopped on his way out.
I think you might be our guest for a while, Ermeline. They booked you in when you got here.
Meaning?
She blew across the coffee cup.
What's booked me in?
You're being held for something.
Will I get to go home today?
Better ask your lawyer about that.
The old man disappeared out the door.
What about that?
She asked Thaddeus. You're being held on suspicion of murder one, pending the result of fingerprint evidence on the gun and knife. The state crime lab has the gun and knife, and they're dusting them for prints, probably also looking for DNA, at least on the knife.
Oh, that's a relief. They won't find my prints there.
Yes, that's a relief. We need to keep that hope alive, that they'll see you haven't touched the weapons and decide there's no reason to hold you. She shuddered.
How long will it take?
Crime lab evidence usually takes 2 weeks. He looked down. He took a small sip of coffee.
2 weeks?
Yes, afraid so.
I'll be locked up for 2 weeks.
We'll have an initial appearance tomorrow before Judge Prelate. I'll ask him to release you on your own recognizance, meaning you would sign a bond and get out.
Will he allow that?
She sipped her coffee and made a face.
Instant?
He'll probably want some security, real estate or a cash bond, something to ensure you show up for the trial, something to guarantee you don't flee.
I'm not fleeing. This is where I live.
I know, but the system looks at it differently. It's a statutory requirement that bail of some sort be posted in certain cases. Yours is one of those. They talked for another 30 minutes about bail and the possibilities for release. Ermeline asked at the end of it,
What about Jamie? Does he just stay with my mom?
I don't see any reason why not. That would probably be the court's first choice.
What's the court got to do with it?
Ermeline, sometimes when a parent gets jailed and there's no other parent around, the court has to place the child.
Meaning?
They look for someone to keep the child while the single parent is being held, locked up.
Well, my mom gets him. That's a no-brainer.
She began weeping freely now.
Oh, my stars.
She repeated over and over.
Oh, my stars. Oh, my stars. Oh, my stars. Oh, my stars. Oh, my stars.
We'll know once I talk to the district attorney. He's the one who would bring a dependency petition for placement of Jamie. I'm sure he won't want to file. He'll just let your mom step in.
Thank goodness.
And there's one more thing I have to ask.
What's that?
Officially, do you want me to represent you in this case?
Absolutely. I wouldn't have it any other way.
I'm just asking because you could probably get the public defender.
Why in heaven's name would I do that? You're my lawyer, Thaddeus. I chose you.
Well, when and if charges get filed tomorrow, I'll enter my appearance and a plea of not guilty. I'll also file a motion for conditions of release and try to get you sprung from here.
That would be appreciated.
Okay, so we've got a lot of work to do. Now, I'll see if I can get you a TV or radio or something in here.
Not necessary. I don't plan to be here that long. I'll ask anyway, just in case.
Thaddeus's next stop Christmas morning was Quentin's home. The house itself was a ranch style of salmon-colored brick and a red slate roof. It sat on a small hill set back off Washington 300 yards, with no trees and no landscaping. The horses were fenced off by a white fence that encircled the entire ranch and then made geometric shapes, rectangles, and squares on the interior of the property. The closest they got to District Attorney Irwin's house was 25 yards. The horses often were found close by, grazing along the nearest fences, in hope the Irwin kids would bring carrots and apples, as they often did. Thaddeus pulled up on the east side of the house and parked just outside the three-car garage. He entered through the garage and rang the doorbell. Quentin Irwin Jr. answered the door. He was wearing jeans, a t-shirt that said Go Cardinals, with a stylized picture of a quarterback about to pass the ball, slippers, and he was holding a glass of eggnog. He lifted the glass to Thaddeus.
"You can come in and riddle me with your questions, but only if you'll have an eggnog."
"Done," said Thaddeus, "because I've got a million questions."
"Sure you do. Come on in. I don't have an office here, but we can sit at the dining room table and talk."
Quentin led Thaddeus to the dining room, and they both sat. Donna Irwin appeared in minutes, two fresh eggnogs in hand.
"Hey, Thad," she said. "Hear there's trouble uptown."
"Thanks," Thad said, accepting the drink. "Yeah, your husband is after my client."
"Whoa," said Quentin. "Let's get one thing straight. It won't be me prosecuting Ermeline. I've got a conflict of interest. I've already called the Attorney General. They'll be handling any prosecution, if there even is one."
Thaddeus's ears perked up.
"You mean there might not be a prosecution after all?"
"Depends on the crime lab, I'd say. The AG may see it differently, but without positive results from the crime lab, I don't see a case."
Thaddeus frowned and lowered his voice.
"Quentin, someone's after my client. Someone's trying to frame her. She would never shoot Vic Harrow."
"Agreed. But right now it looks like she did. It's your job to prove otherwise."
"I thought it was the state's job to prove her guilty beyond a reasonable doubt."
"Sure, that's what the books all say. Truth is, you're gonna have to prove her innocent. That's how it works in the real world."
Thaddeus sat back and took a large mouthful of the drink. His mind was churning. How was he ever going to prove her innocent? Georgiana Armentrout was in her mid-50s, lived in a single wide and shady oak acres north of Orbit, kept two parrots and a Pekingese, and had one daughter, Ermeline Ransom, and one grandson, Jamie. She was a widow. She had killed her husband in a hunting accident 10 years earlier when they were hunting in LaGrange Township. They had been hunting deer, using shotguns and shotgun slugs as authorized by Illinois law, when Dan Armentrout handed his gun to Georgiana and ducked through a barbed wire fence. He made it to the other side and was holding down the bottom wire with his foot when Georgiana went to hand him the two guns, to pass them through the wire. Unfortunately, they were passed muzzle first. The trigger of Dan's gun caught on her hunting jacket button, and the gun fired, blowing a hole the size of a mason jar in his chest, where his heart used to be. Quentin Irwin Jr.'s predecessor in the district attorney's office, a mean-spirited little man named Blaine Maddock, now deceased in a boating accident of his own, sought to bring charges against Georgiana for the shooting death, and through some legal wizardry, blind man's bluff, and hide the ball, managed to convince a Hickman County grand jury to indict Georgiana Armentrout for third-degree murder. Things went bad to worse for her from there, because she had no money, had to accept the court-appointed attorney, and the luck of the draw wound her up with attorney Fletcher T. Franey. Since receiving his law license in 1970, it had been attorney Franey's practice with criminal defendants to plead them guilty first and find out the facts later, if at all. Which is exactly what he did in Georgiana's case. Against her better judgment, she let Franey talk her into a plea agreement, where she would plead guilty to manslaughter, serve 6 months in the Hickman County Jail, and 2 years of probation. She did her time, talked to enough jailhouse lawyers while incarcerated to understand that she had been hornswoggled by Franey and came out a new woman with one goal in life: to avoid lawyers, judges, police, and prosecutors for the rest of her life. She wouldn't even let them pass her by on the street, always preferring to cross over, literally,
than have any chance of eye contact or contamination by their ilk. She never voted in general or special elections and didn't care who held what office. She had seen enough government in her 40 years to swear off forever.
"I've been cured of that,"
she would say about officialdom. It was Georgiana who awoke to Charlie Altman's knock at Ermeline Ransom's door that Christmas morning, and it was Georgiana who was told, in no uncertain terms, that the cops outside had a search warrant and they were coming in. Georgiana pulled open the door and stood aside, clutching her robe at the neck.
"What the hell do you devils want?"
she spat at Sheriff Altman as he came through the door.
"Morning to you, Georgie," said Altman with a smile. "Sorry to bother you good people on Christmas morning, but there's a little problem uptown we need to tend to. Hope you folks can help us out."
"I want nothing to do with you and your problem. Neither does Ermeline. So state your business and leave."
"Afraid it won't be that easy. You see, we have to search the house." "Ermeline home?"
"She's getting decent. She'll be right out."
At that moment, Ermeline emerged, looking drowsy and flustered and wearing a nightshirt that said BS and a pair of blue jeans rolled at the ankles.
"What's up, Charlie?"
she asked the sheriff.
"What in the world are all you peace officers after?"
"We've got a search warrant, Ermeline."
"For what? What did I do?"
"Probably didn't do anything, but we need to take a look around."
Which was the moment Jamie Ransom, all of 5 and full of pep and Christmas morning angst, chose to come bounding into the room, expecting to find a slurry of presents dropped off by Santa, and finding instead 4 complete strangers standing in his living room. He noticed the guns and the badges, and his face clouded over. Tears came to his eyes.
"My daddy got hurt?"
he asked. Sheriff Altman reached across the small room and tousled the youngster's brown hair.
"Your dad is just fine, son. We're just here to look for something we lost."
"Lost that in my room?"
the little boy asked.
"Come on, I'll show you my room."
"Jamie, come up here with Grandma,"
Georgiana said, and patted the couch beside her.
"The men need to find something someplace else. Probably not in your room, probably not here at all,"
she ended, her tone menacing toward the cops.
"So's the quicker we all get set down, the sooner they can leave. Ain't that right, Sheriff Altman?"
"That's exactly right, Georgiana. Ermeline, you too, on the couch, if you would please."
"Well, can I go brew up a pot first?"
"Go ahead, but hurry it along, please."
Ermeline, not particularly nervous about the interruption, went into the kitchen. She figured they had found out about Hector and had come looking for him, which would explain his total absence this morning when she woke up. At first, she had thought he was in the bathroom getting ready for Christmas morning, but then she heard the police voices and her mother's voice in the living room, and she guessed that Hector, as usual, was in some kind of trouble, maybe even for the warrant Hickman County had out for non-support. She wondered if the $6,500 could be used to bargain his way out of any arrest. After all, she thought, he had made good, and he shouldn't have to be arrested for non-support now. She filled the coffee pot with tap water, scooped 3 scoops of Folgers into the basket, and hit the switch. Within seconds, Mr. Coffee was happily underway with its daily routine. She returned to the living room and took a seat on the couch, as the sheriff had requested. By now, the police had spread through her house as she could hear them trading information through the thin walls, although she couldn't make out what was being said. 15 minutes into the search warrant's execution, Sheriff Altman returned to the living room. He was scratching his head.
"Ermeline, do you own a gun?"
Ermeline was taken aback.
"A gun? Never! I've got a 5-year-old living here, whose grandfather was killed in a gun accident."
Emphasis on accident.
"No gun, no way, not ever, not here, Sheriff."
"That's what I figured. Okay, thanks."
The sheriff disappeared, and Ermeline dashed into the kitchen and poured 2 cups of coffee and a small glass of milk. Using her cocktail waitressing skills, she balanced all 3, with saucers and 2 Christmas cookies apiece, and returned to the couch. Jamie inhaled his cookies and immediately asked for more. Before Ermeline could placate the little boy, one of the police officers, Michael Smith, appeared out of the bedroom. Smith was known as the Great Spirit of the Red Bird Inn because he spent so much time at the restaurant chewing donuts and chatting up the farmers and truckers. He came through the living room, exited out to his car, Ermeline supposed, and returned with what looked like a black gym bag. She never did see the opposite end of the bag that read evidence technician in red letters, The cop disappeared back inside Ermeline's bedroom, and what sounded like a conference was held in the bathroom. 5 minutes later, the same cop returned, snugging the evidence bag tight under his arm. He managed a stiff smile and disappeared back outside. Ermeline heard a car trunk slam, and he didn't return again. Evidently, the search was then continued as the threesome on the couch didn't see any sign of the remaining three officers for another 15 minutes. Finally, they all three returned to the living room, and the two uniformed city cops began looking under furniture and inside drawers and behind the entertainment center, looking for heaven only knew what, as far as Ermeline could tell. Sheriff Altman again reached to tousle Jamie's hair, but this time the boy ducked. He stuck out his tongue. Clearly he had inherited his grandma's distaste of law enforcement officers. Ermeline told him that that was enough, that these men were guests and should be treated nicely.
"Tell the truth, Ermeline," Sheriff Altman all but stammered. "I'm going to have to ask you to ride up to the office with me."
The little boy's ears perked up.
"Mama ain't leaving. We got to do Christmas, mister."
"I'm sorry, son, but I need to borrow Mama for a while. She'll come back soon,"
he lied, and the whites of his eyes showed as he said it, knowing he had just lied to a 5-year-old. There were some things about this job a man could really come to hate, and Ermeline picked up on his thoughts and feelings. This wasn't good. She could read that between the lines. Something was definitely up, and it involved her, too. Maybe not just Hector.
"This about Hector?"
Ermeline asked.
"What's he done now?"
"We can talk on the way uptown. I'd just as soon wait for privacy,"
Sheriff Altman said and nodded at the boy.
"Let me get a coat and slip into some boots. Be right back."
Sheriff Altman waited, and Georgiana totally ignored him, hating him from a distance, until she could finally stand no more and went to the kitchen for a refill.
"Mama,"
Ermeline called to her,
"you watch Jamie while I'm out?"
"Of course. No need to ask,"
she shouted back.
"Just take the cops with you when you leave, and we'll be fine here."
Sheriff Altman could only smile. He knew all about Georgiana and her hatred of all things official, especially cops. In a way, he didn't even blame her, he thought, kicking himself for telling a whopper just minutes before. They had found a gun and a bloody knife. Ermeline wouldn't be returning any time soon. He was getting too old for this crapola, he told himself. 3 more years, and he'd have his 20. Then, adios. He was off to Florida like every other sane mortal. Ermeline reappeared, dressed for the weather. Jamie leapt into her arms, and she bear-hugged him, whispered in his ear, and carried him into his grandma. Sheriff Altman held the door for Ermeline as she went outside before him. Neither said a word on the way to the sheriff's office and, finally, to jail. She was booked in at 7:45 a.m. Christmas morning, and the jailer escorted her back to the jail cell she would now call home, at least for now. That afternoon, the governor and Mrs. Walker welcomed the governor's cabinet to the Christmas Day dinner that was always held in Springfield at the governor's mansion each year. This red-brick Italianate mansion in downtown Springfield had been the home of Illinois governors since 1855, when Joel A. Madison and his family moved in. On February 13, 1857, the Lincolns attended a party which a writer from the Illinois State Journal called a delightful and magnificent entertainment. Carefully restored in 1971, the building houses many treasures. When you walk inside, you immediately see the exquisite elliptical stairway which leads to the spacious rooms decorated in British Regency style. Once upstairs, you can see portraits of the Lincolns and their friend Edward D. Baker, a bust of Lincoln modeled from life by Thomas D. Jones, bedroom furniture given to the Lincolns, and a spectacular table presented to President Lincoln, which contained more than 20,000 pieces of inlaid wood. After greeting his guests and their husbands and wives, Governor Walker managed to sneak away with Attorney General Robert K. Amastagio. They crept upstairs to the Lincoln bedroom, where they sat at the great man's inlaid writing desk and put their heads together. The governor had downed 2 quick gin and tonics in anticipation of the day's guests, most of whom he hated, and most of whom were trying to replace him with themselves, and he wasted no time getting down to the real reason for the get-together.
"That girl in orbit, I want her prosecuted with every last atom of power in the Attorney General's office,"
the governor spat at his AG.
"Without her held responsible, people are going to start digging deeper. Bury her now and do it fast."
The Attorney General took a long pull at his bud in a bottle, his drink of choice.
"We're already working on that. I've assigned the case to my chief prosecutor, Rolanda Barr, now that Quentin Irwin Jr. has declared a conflict. She's a magnificent trial attorney. Her record is 62-0 and counting. All homicide cases, all conflicted, out by local DAs.
There was a stroke of luck.
Mr. Irwin claimed he had counseled the girl in his office, the alleged assault on her by Vic Harrow. You know, the name carved in her boobs.
Yes, what about that?
The AG shrugged. You said to put the fear of death in Vic Harrow. Johnny Bladani did that with his knife. It worked.
It worked only to the tune of 25,000.
Kleeman, that's all the guy had. We've been over all his records. Everything was mortgaged to the hilt. Liens everywhere like Democrats in South Chicago.
Funny man. Okay, so strike fast and give me a conviction. Other contributors to the governor's retirement campaign will get the message. Pay up or leave in a cheap coffin.
So when you retire, it will be my turn to take on the responsibilities of the governorship? Let's not forget where we're headed here.
Never forgotten. You will have my endorsement and the party's leaders in your corner. It's a shoo-in in 2016.
Excellent.
Now get me a conviction. I just hope this Rulanda Barr is everything you say she is.
Not to worry. She could convict John the Baptist at the Mount Israel First Baptist Church.
Music to my ears.
Music to our ears.
Now, let's go rub shoulders with the criminals I call my cabinet.